That devastating earthquake. Greetings, 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 and welcome. Welcome to Caribbean Forum, here on the Uhuru Radio Network, where we expand our ability to communicate and unite the African people toward victory in our independence. I'm Ron Bob Semple, and here on the Forum, we examine issues that affect Caribbean and Caribbean American nationals, both at home and across the diaspora. We bring you news, views, interviews, thought-provoking discussions, Caribbean theater of the mind, and of course, musical interludes. Well, he was born on February 6, 1945, to Norville Marley and Sedella Marley Booker. I'm referring to Robert Nestor Marley, more popularly known to the world as Bob Marley. We will celebrate his birthday by sharing with you an interview when he appeared on the television broadcast Like It Is, hosted by the late Gil Noble. We continue our monthly segment of Mind Your Business with Vice President of Aegis Capital Corp, Valence Williams, and Real Estate Agent Joe Thomas. During our second hour, we will welcome back to Caribbean Forum historian and author Ayusi Kwayana, whose book Walter Rodney, His Last Days and Campaigns, is one that should be a part of your library. Because of the death in the family of Felicia Passad, the CEO of Heartbeat Communications, Felicia will not be with us this morning to analyze the Caribbean news, and we extend our condolences to Felicia and her entire family. And I'd also like to convey my personal condolences to the family of my high school classmate, Wilford Beckles, who we lost last month in Brooklyn. So tell someone that Caribbean Forum is on the air for the next 2 hours here on the Uhuru Radio Network, where you can log on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, for live and recorded programming. Thanks for your continued support. So to your leisure, you can make any donation that you deem affordable by logging on to uhurunews.com. Well, you should be on the website if you're listening to us right now, and you can just click on the donate button and make your contribution. No amount is too large or too small. And if there's someone you know who does not have access to a computer right now, you let them know that they can listen to us on their landline, their iPhone or iPad by dialing 1-425-905-1825. That's 425-905-1825, and follow the prompts. Now here is Bob Marley in an exclusive interview with the late Gil Noble, host of Like It Is.
Pleased to have you as a guest on Like It Is.
Thank you.
How did it all start? Had music always been a part of your life from when you were a little boy?
Yeah, you know, growing up, musical family, grandfather, mother, uncle, sister, Pitney, everything.
What part of Jamaica?
St. Anne's, you know.
Yeah?
It's in the country.
What town?
A town called Rodnall. It's not well known, you know. It's a little place up in the hills, you know.
Yeah. How big is your family?
Well, my family is really a big family, you know. Malcolm, their family name is Malcolm. It's a plenty.
That's a good name.
Yeah.
When did you begin to get involved in music, really?
About 1958.
Doing what?
Well, I was interested in music, but that time I was learning trade, you know, and meet up some guys who can sing. One named Desmond Decker. And so we started out from kind of rehearse together and thing, you know. And then one day we went away, do some recording. Then I fell after.
Mm-hmm. You weren't doing the same kind of things then that you're doing now. What kind of music was it in the beginning?
That music was ska.
Ska?
Ska music, yeah.
Well, how does ska differ from reggae?
Ska is different in sound, different in style, different playing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Ska is a more quicker music mm-hmm. than reggae.
No relation?
Yeah, it's almost the same music breakdown, if it go much slower, you know.
Uh-huh. Same root.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
It's almost the same music, scare. But only say now, if it was playing at 33, it started playing at 7.5, you know.
I hear
a bit more.
That's a good analogy. How does reggae and ska come out of calypso? Many people ask that.
Yeah, because the calypso was always there first.
Right.
You know? And then now, when the musician in Jamaica started to play, although them can play calypso too, because they play a lot of calypso.
Mm.
But because the American influence music come past you down there, you know, them start to kind of get more to, them time you start Fats Domino.
Yes.
And plenty of them type of people. So, after a while now, the music start drift from the reggae. So it used to be a music almost like a half blues. It used to play before the ska start, you know. Even people like Joe Higgs, cha-na-na, cha-na-na-na-na, cha-na-na, cha-na-na-na, you know that music?
Right.
Used to play that plenty.
Uh-huh.
So from there now it developed. So people start ching, 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 ching for ska, you know.
Right.
And then for rocksteady is like ching, ching, ching. For reggae now is check, 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 you know. So you have three different feel. But the three of them can put together again and make one thing still.
Now, calypso music, most of it dealt with family and folk stories. And love, and beautiful island in the sun, things
yeah.
like that. How did it move into what we're getting in the music now, where we have message?
Because during that time of this calypso and thing, people never wasn't so conscious about Africa and where them roots come from.
Mm.
Since reggae come now, people get, I mean, not from a point of music, because music is always conscious. But since the reggae come now, the reggae start talk about Africa, blackness, you know, in a militant way. So that is how it kind of, that is how the lyrics differ from the Island in the Sun.
Well, who are some of your influences?
Well, I think my biggest influence is Marcus Garvey and Selassie.
Yeah.
Sure.
From what you heard coming up as a boy about Garvey, or what you've learned now that you're grown, or what?
What to hear, what to read, you know, and what to know about him.
Did you learn much about Garvey in school?
No.
Yeah.
Yes, them don't teach. It's education that we don't get in school, you know. we don't get that type of education that when we grow up we can know who we is. Mm-hmm. We get a more education that we might know who Christopher Columbus is, how Marco Polo is, you know. But we never really know who Marcus Garvey is, who Haile Selassie is, or who any black man is.
Were you born as a Rasta? How did that evolve?
Well, I figure, you know, I was born, you know, and then born and growing. There was a certain amount of consciousness in myself that, you know, it was always a lonely world, not finding people who might think like me, you know.
Not
to say that I think so different, but because this consciousness about God and the people I'm come from is more Christian, you know. We always try to do, like, try to stand up not right. But we used to find out now that one church quarreling against the next church, and I figure I never want any of that, you know. I never want to really enter into the thing where this one will fight against that one and everybody talking about God still. So after going on and coming up, you know, the thing that was there get more stronger, come to Kingston, meet some more people, them people is Rasta. You talk to them and find out it's the same thing I have inside. It's the same thing.
How old were you when this started to happen?
This is about 17, 18, you know. I find out that's the same thing when I deal with, the same thing where the Rasta man talk about. So that is how I could identify myself as a Rasta. By not changing, you know.
Now, what happened when you went back home and told your family what you had found?
Oh, I never have a home to go back to.
No?
No. Where we from, everybody gone, you know.
Uh-huh.
Everybody gone. Everybody living in America, some living in Kingston, everybody gone. So, never really have a home, not that much, although we used to have a home before grandfather died, you know. But after grandfather died, everything gets crashed. So,
you came to Kingston, and that's where it began to happen.
Yeah.
Where did you live in Kingston? What part?
East. I'm calling it East Kingston.
Mm-hmm.
Out near the east. Yeah. And then we go up a place named Oxford Street, you know, down to Spanish Town Road, down to then up to Trenchtown.
Yes. So for a long time, things were kind of lean.
Well, yes, things was kind of lean as can. It leave to what is your expectation anyhow, do you know? To me, it was lean, but I could understand it because coming from a country where you learn to do things like you don't learn to depend on family and all of that, you know. You go out and you plant your own corn and you watch the corn grow. When the corn grow, you pick your own corn, you know what I mean?
Yes.
All of them fruits on them tree, you can get them, you know. So
it's a little different though in town.
Yeah.
You know, you got to do different things to eat, eh?
Well, when you're in the city, it's a whole different ball game, you know.
Right.
People have to go to work, catch the bus. You know, the country, all the day, you go for the donkey, and you ride the donkey to the farm, and you're cool, you know.
Right.
You know, the city, people hustle, catch the bus, go to work, get off of work, come back home, you know. So it was a different thing up there.
I know a little bit about Jamaica, and I understand in Kingston, Trenchtown is a rough part of town. How did you survive?
Well, while living in Trenchtown, you know, as a young man, surviving was easy. The only thing you'd have to really look out for was the police, you know. Because the police could just get you, frame you, you go to prison, and because you come from Trenchtown, you know, Trenchtown's a from them say, where you from? They say, Trenchtown, you're gone. You know what I mean? You get shipped out.
You know, a lot of people are confused about what a Rasta really is and have a very negative image of the Rasta. Tell us what a Rasta is.
See, Christ promised that he will return within 2,000 years, you know, and he said when he come, he will be the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords, the conqueror of the Lion of Judah, through the lineage of King Solomon and King David. Now, my life have great meaning to me. So I really search to find out if God is here. And I search, I look in Ethiopia, I look all about, looking at Germany, you know, because me no prejudice. Me look for God. Me looking at Ethiopia, I see one man stand up with these names, Emperor Haile Selassie, name King of Kings, Lord of Lords, conquering land of Judah, through the lineage of King Solomon and King David, written in the Bible. Now, one of my thing is that the Bible, them say that King James edit the Bible. Now, my understanding is that if King James edit the Bible, I don't think he would edit it for the benefit of black people. So when the revelation turned out that Haile Selassie is the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, coming straight through the lineage of King Solomon and King David, then, you know, we really know that this is a Christ return, because we know in this world, yeah, when the white man, when the white man edit it, he wouldn't edit it in our behalf. You know, he would have more edited to make it look like England going to be the big, big thing. But in the last days, they'll prove out that is Ethiopia, Haile Selassie, you know. And Haile Selassie's name is Rasta. So we are called Rastas, you know, called by his name.
Uh-huh.
And then it's a lot of things. We go as far as saying, him say, when him return and you call upon him, now this is God, him say, when him return and you call upon him, your mother and your father will forsake you. Now, we know that if you call upon the Catholics, them embrace you. You call upon the Church of God, them embrace you. Any religion you call upon, you might get embraced. The only religion them push you off from is Rasta. But that just make the truth more real, because them say, when you call upon my name, your mother and your father will forsake you. And that is why today you hear Rasta get so much bad name. It's not because Rasta do anything bad, but it's because all the prophecy go with it. When you, if your mother and your father will forsake you, just imagine people who don't even know you. You know what I mean?
Well, in most religions, you go to church on Sunday, and you may go to a Bible class once or twice during the week,
true,
and that's it.
Yeah.
Is it pretty much basically the same in Rasta, or is it more involved?
No, we say that the man is the church. The Bible is there. But what we find out now is that a lot of people read the Bible, but they don't understand the Bible, because the approach to the Bible is wrong. I mean, there's no way you can read a book. You just take up a book and just read it in the middle and figure you can find out what was happening from the beginning to the middle. The Bible is a whole book with a whole tradition in it. And from them read to Genesis to Revelation, the whole truth of the whole straight road, the overstanding is there, you know. Says not a several, then we just go church and do like the other Christian. We know that the man is a church, you know, because you see, you just can't overthrow the truth, you know. We, our people, our roots, when we search for it, we find it in a Rasta, because we don't see, there's no other way, we don't see no other way. It's Rasta, we find the roots in there, you know.
How do you handle fame?
I handle fame by not being famous.
Come on, you know you're a famous man.
No, I mean, you know, not to me.
No?
Not famous to me.
Some people get drunk off of fame.
See, I learned from he was coming in, from I just started music, you know. The people them want me. Them show me, say, hey, this game is a game where if you don't mind sharp, you lose your consciousness. So the only way you can lose your consciousness is because if you figure, say, you're getting, some people say, Ray, your head might get swell.
Right.
And if your head swell, that's it. So, you know, really don't keep my head in a bandage that it can't swell. True.
How do you handle the women that come at you in droves? People have visions of women beating down the door to get at Bob Jesus. Marley and grabbing clothes. Is it like that?
No.
No?
No. money's, you know.
Is it difficult, though, to keep your balance and not, you know, get to feeling that you're more important than you really are when so many people are after you all the time for different things?
No, you see, I don't think, I never really check myself, you know, I know I am benefit to the people, you know. That's the only consciousness I have of myself, that I can be beneficial to a people, you know. And I don't know anything else. I don't know that.
What do you think it is that has made Bob Marley such a big name?
I think, you know, maybe it's just what Bob Marley stand for.
What is that?
The truth. And the determination to stay alive and survive. You know?
You have a record out called Survival.
Yeah. That was last year.
Yeah. Did anything happen to you that caused you to write that?
Well, 1976, I'm shoot off of me, right?
Yes.
And I figured that was survival, you know?
Yeah. What happened when you were shot? You were in your home.
Yeah.
Was it in the morning or at night or what happened?
Well, it was about 9 o'clock in the night.
Yeah.
What happened is that the night before, about 3 nights before that, I was living at a place called Bulby, you know? Mm. And I went to about 3 o'clock in the morning and get some sleep. And then I vision I was in a lot of gunshot, you know? That was a dream. I was in a barrage, a gunshot, but when it all over, you know, it's like me never really getting a shot. But me see my mother get shot. You know, the vision show my mother get shot in her head. And what happened is that the vision said, don't run. You know, it's like, do you know all of this gunshot? It's like something that the vision said, don't run, stand up. So when the gunshot started firing on Hope Road, the first thing come back to my mind was the vision. And all I could remember is that the vision said, don't run. And so me have to stand up, you know. And, you know, them fire until I was tired of fire, and then two is not really a lawful gun battle. Man starts to run and it ease up, you know.
And that where was, were you hit?
Eh?
Where were you hit?
Me? Yes, sir.
Yeah. Went right through? Or just skin?
No, I'm said lodge inside there.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You never saw the gunman?
Well, at that time, no.
But you know who did it?
They ever knew them.
Were they caught?
No, but I don't call the police. Mm. Just, you know,
you have a record company now.
Yeah.
Why?
Oh, you know, a long time we always have a record company. What we have now is a recording studio. When we go into the studio to work, it was a lot of hassle. I mean, we're a raster, you know. Some people don't want a raster in them studio. No, if we stop all of this, you have to make one. Because, you know what I mean, a man might say, don't you say, Haile Selassie, a god? Well, you know what I mean? Go and build your own studio. You know what I mean? So, all right, Haile Selassie is god, I'm going to go and build a studio, you know? So, you know what I mean? And I said, go. Is it them things come through sabotage and through pressure? If everything was nice, maybe we wouldn't have to build a studio. But, you know, it's just a tricky place. It's not everyone really have that humanitarian feeling. Some people just deal with them, they don't know what I'm dealing with.
Mm. What's ahead for Bob Marley, do you know? Do you have an agenda or a master plan?
Well, I feel ahead for I and I is the unity of Africa. And then when the unity of Africa come, then people will really understand, say, you know, there was something in this thing. There is something in it.
Do you think of yourself more as an African than a Jamaican?
Yeah, because one of the main things is that we're Rasta. From you accept Rasta, you become a Ethiopian, which is Africa. Next thing again, the history of Jamaica shows that the Arawak Indian was living there, and it belonged to the Arawak Indian. Now, our history shows that through slave business, black people come out of the Western thing, you know? So we still figure, say, Africa is a root, you know, and this is where we must return to.
What do you see as most of Africa's problems as far as uniting? I mean,
I see Africa problem is that outside people keep on fatiguing the people, you know, and make them can't really get them things together, you know. If it's not this superpower, it's that superpower. But Africa is only a place which problem is exploit, you know. Nobody know really. Africa so rich that it become a man just going to Africa, steal out of a man, steal and carry back in a free country. And Africa stayed alike, you know. Well, Africa ready.
Garvey used to say Africa for the Africans. Is that how you feel?
Yeah, Africa for Africans, a woman abroad, you know. True.
Will your home base, though, always be Jamaica? Or someday would you like to live in Africa?
No, someday going to be in Africa.
Yeah.
Maybe we up in Jerusalem. You know what I mean? And in Babylon.
And what do you think lies ahead for Jamaica?
I think what lies ahead for Jamaica is that Jamaica is a beautiful island. The best thing Jamaica could have been. It's just like how Jamaica, like how England owned Jamaica. Jamaica must make some part of Africa own Jamaica. You know what I mean? And it work more nicer, I mean, you know. But if it's going to be a thing which part, we always have going to have a war. Because, you know, the solution is either them get themselves with Nigeria or with someone, you know what I mean? But make Jamaica become some African, something to do with Africa, that's Africa, who in Jamaica, you know? But because the people and them whole ideology and philosophy where they want to come with, you know, some people want to be Marxist, some want to be this, some want to be that, and plenty of people don't want to be with them is, and with them is African, and Africa have its own culture, and its own people, and, you know, all it needs is people who keep it down for either die out of the earth or something.
What is your feeling about the condition of black people here in the United States?
I feel like black people should develop themselves, you know, not to settle down, just developing up yourself having a prejudice thing to it. It's just that we are people with our own history and culture. We can educate ourselves. I mean, we are the first creators. So we have to really, everything we see on this earth here, the black man make it. And I'm saying that the white man don't make some, but all wisdom come from the black man.
You know, a lot of young viewers look up to you and are going to want to hang on every word and every syllable. Do you have a message for young people?
Well, you know, the whole thing again is to really check out the truth of Rasta and don't make like fallyism. Don't make it check it out. And don't get too busy that you can't check out the truth. Because the truth is there. And Africa awaits its creators. And we know that the people in the West, headwise, is them ready, you know? Them have to learn, come learn. What I'm learning in the West, them have to care at home to them people, make it be a benefit to the people. Because, I mean, how long must the black people suffer? And these are people, you know? And then we have our own culture, we have everything. We don't shout at anything. We have everything. Plus, we have a land that no one is living there. And we must go home to it. And when you go home, you can build all of these big buildings if you want. I mean, if you miss a city, build a city. You know what I mean? If you want a car, you can get a car. I mean, I don't see the big thing. One time America was, you know what I mean, maybe used to have lots of all what I call it, all sort of thing I walk through. Africa is a peaceful place. Them want to fool black people, boys, a jungle and blah, blah, boom, boom.
Where have you been in Africa besides Ethiopia?
Zimbabwe.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Gabon.
How did Zimbabwe strike you?
Well, you know, Zimbabwe, nice, man. Zimbabwe, really nice. I mean, you know, it's like a paradise in a place. You know, when you go in and see. Beautiful.
How did the people react to you?
People's great. Yeah. People good. You know, them places, when you go and you see how the people, how the land set up, you see people living. You see a man having a mouse for a nice pizza. And then the whole thing about it, the climate, you can go out all the while. You know what I mean? The climate nice outside. Yeah. If you want to look upon a few lions and things, you can walk and go. And if you want to see some things that man never make, but it look like somebody make it. As all Zimbabwe too. Because I go in a place and I see some stone farm. Where I know it's not the man make it, but the wheat farm, you know, is higher than something.
It's really been a pleasant and informative experience talking to you, Brother Marley.
Nice.
I thank you for your time.
I agree.
Wish you well.
Pasta.
Yes, that was an interview conducted in 1980 with Bob Marley and the late Gil Noble on the television broadcast Like It Is. Bob Marley would have been 68 years old on February 6th. He died May 11th, 1981. You're listening to Caribbean Forum.
This is Felicia Brassard. The Uhuru Radio Network has news and culture direct from Africa, the Caribbean, and wherever Africans are working, playing, and fighting to be free. Support Uhuru today.
Are you tired of too many reruns on Uhuru Radio? Want more live shows and fresh music? We do too. And we need your help. Uhuru Radio is upgrading. To serve you better, we are getting new broadcast software and new equipment for new and better programming. We need to raise $1,000 this month to make that change. So go to the Uhuru Radio donate link now and contribute whatever you can. No donation is too large or too small. Uhuru Radio is your media. We need your support. Donate today. On Sundays from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, we'll bring you Golden Sunday Sounds with me, Ron Bob Temple. A relaxing 3 hours of music from around the world. Music is the food of love. So tune in every Sunday evening from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Golden Sunday Sounds.
Simple, the voice of reason.
And now, here is Mind Your Business with Valance Williams and Joe Thomas.
back to Caribbean Forum. I'm Ron Bob Semple with you here on the Uhuru Radio Network every Saturday from 9 until 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Well, here's our installment of Mind Your Business. And joining us this morning, the Vice President of Aegis Capital Corp, Valence Williams, and Real Estate Agent Joe Thomas. Gentlemen, good morning and welcome once
again. Good morning. Good morning, Val here. How are you?
Well, good morning to you, Val. I must say that you sound pretty bright in spite of that weather up in New York City.
Yeah, don't remind me, man. I just came out of... I stopped trying to shove the snow, man. I see the younger dudes to do that. Yeah.
Be careful, man. As they say, you got to bend your knees, right?
Yeah. Well
gentlemen... Yes, sir.
Valence, I have a spot in the sunshine down here for you.
Oh, my goodness.
Some sunshine.
Yeah, he is yeah. Going to rub it in, isn't he?
Well, you know, it is interesting that I'm being attacked from left and right with this thing, because one of the topics is climate change.
Absolutely. It's an absolutely
it
beautiful
like
segment.
No one is safe these days. That is very true.
Well, gentlemen, the last time we met on Mind Your Business, we were talking about, you know, foreign account, the tax compliance, the problems in the Caribbean banks and the financial institutions, and also the massive rum subsidies to U.S. Caribbean territories. And this week, Valence, you opened the door. We're going to talk about the economic effects of climate change in the Caribbean.
Oh, man, it's interesting. You see the whole coincidence of this snow right now and you guys mentioning sunshine. But it's quite interesting to see that in the Caribbean. First, let's make it a macro thing. There is global warming. Because when you guys moved to the to Florida, I know you must have heard from some of your friends of you going into the hurricane belt, and that was said by people that lived in New York. Then came Hurricane Sandy, and you know what the impact of Hurricane Sandy has done. It's
absolutely
$50 billion, right? Now let's take the Caribbean, where there are two economic things that have been. What we call tourism, which should be turned over, the word should be really entertainment, so you could join gambling and a whole bunch of things, because the climate change is starting to affect the tourist industry. You know, they're not generating as much revenue. And then they, within the last 10 years, ecotourism became very popular. So climate change and disruption of the environment changes the whole ecotourism thing. So we're in quite a bit of a quagmire. From the agricultural standpoint, most of the Caribbean countries are either exporting rice, sugar, crops of that, bananas, and the Europeans are already putting pressure on the pricing structure. So we indeed have an economic problem, a global economic problem, that is impacting on the Caribbean with climate change. So that is one of the ways I would start with that, because I am, in my research and speaking to my friends in the agricultural sector, they're taking a bit of a beating right now, Because as you would take, for instance, I was looking at Portia Simpson's recent address to her people, and Jamaica is encountering probably one of the highest debt-ridden situations currently. They're looking perhaps at a 1% growth. As we know, Jamaica is one of the more beautiful islands in the world. What is happening? The International Monetary Fund, of course, is trying to do some things, but Jamaica would have to do some more things on the fiscal side.
Absolutely.
You also have now, there's a little bit of a better situation in Suriname and Trinidad and Belize because of the natural resources. Trinidad has the oil and natural gas. Guyana is doing pretty good, I must say, and Suriname in the areas of gold, the mining and mineral sector. Providing that the price of gold these you know, price of metals stay high, then they may be able to go through that. But I think that we have to do perhaps really long-term planning when it comes to the economic impact of climate change. And you have to shift to, it's all adapting, you know. There has to be a paradigm shift in the way we deal with the fact that there is a reality of climate change, and it's affecting tourism, and it's affecting the agricultural sector.
Absolutely. Well, Valens, it has been reported that Caribbean governments are sleepwalking on this climate change issue.
Well, I understand that, but I've always taken the position that rather than the criticism is real, but rather than be critical, is how can we, you know, what can we do? What can we do? How can we make suggestions?
Right, absolutely.
Anyone going to listen? You know, that kind of thing. You know, it's the old Kennedy thing. Ask not what your country could do for you, and what you can do for your country. You know,
yeah, because a World Bank study has determined some time ago that 10 to 15 of the countries most vulnerable to climate conditions are in the Caribbean. A disaster that could have a major systemic impact in the Caribbean societies, which have seen hurricanes and floods wipe out the equivalent of up to 80% of the gross domestic product.
Yeah, and I mean, think about that, and we have a man in that understands the housing sector. When you get hit with a storm and a hurricane, your buildings are gone. Look at what happened there, right up here in the Northeast, you know what I mean? That and I guess you can add to that what really happens to people in the real estate. you better diversify when it comes. You know, you gotta have real estate, I guess, all over the world.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm glad that you made that point, Alex, because what is happening in the Caribbean in some areas is that the prices of land and homes have gotten to a point where the locals can't even buy some of the prime areas.
Man, you just hit on a point that is amazing, because I have a friend who's putting my name on advertising for selling some land in Guyana. When he put a half an acre of land for $110,000, I was like, "Are you nuts?" But people are buying.
Exactly.
The same thing is happening in Jamaica and Trinidad.
It's all listed in U.S. dollars.
Right, I was just about saying that, just to make it clear, Valens, that $110,000 is not Guyana dollars.
No, that's U.S. dollars, man. That's U.S. dollars. Everything in the Caribbean is listed in U.S. dollars, because the attempt is really to sell to the diaspora and expatriates, you know what I mean? And that is creating price inflation. It's amazing.
Yeah. Tobago is a unique example, because in Tobago, a lot of the families have refused to sell to anybody who is not a national of Trinidad and Tobago or somebody from the Caribbean. And that has caused some problems in people saying, well, you know, it's discriminatory and all that sort of stuff. But I know from my family in Tobago, I have an uncle there who told me straight up, he said, "This land is for our family. If you guys want to come and buy, I'll sell to you. Other than that, this is our home. We're not selling it to anybody."
Speaking of homes, I'm so
happy to hear that, because I have a very deep Tobago connection. Desmond Alfred and I met as freshmen at Howard University. He went and helped out the Guyana soccer team. He spent about 20-something years, and he just went back to Tobago. And he's got a lot of land, and he's doing some building. And we discussed this just a couple of weeks ago. I should be heading to Tobago in a couple of months. The Germans were smart enough to recognize the quality of Tobago many, many moons ago. So they spread the word in Europe. And at some point, you have to stop them, or the Germans were going to own the whole of Tobago. So I'm very happy to hear that, to be honest.
Well, the THA, the Tobago government, actually made that a law at one point, and it was very controversial, you know. But outside of the law, on a one-to-one basis, Tobagonians are not selling their land to people outside of the Caribbean.
Yeah, and I had a chat years ago with Orville London, who is currently the chief secretary in Orville was right, you know. I mean, he, that's one of his ideas, man. Let's hold this thing down, because if you don't watch it, your whole country belongs to somebody else. It's happy.
Joe, as a real estate agent, when a potential home buyer, be it a first-time homeowner, is there concern with the different weather patterns that are occurring throughout the world, and they're concerned as to whether they should get flood insurance or hurricane insurance or anything of the sort?
Well, if you're talking about Florida, those are given. I mean, if you're in a flood zone, you should get flood insurance. There are some areas, like for instance Tampa, where we are. Tampa has not had a major hurricane hit in about 25 years. That doesn't say that this hurricane season coming up, we might not get hit. So you always have to look at making sure that you have the insurance. Another thing that people tend to shy away from is sinkholes. You know, every part of Florida could have a sinkhole problem. Every house in Florida could have a sinkhole problem. The good news is that the technology now is at a point where you can have that sinkhole problem fixed, and your house would be better than several other homes that do not have a sinkhole problem. And you get, some of these companies are giving you a lifetime guarantee after that. You know, so these are some of the things that people don't know and need to be educated about before they purchase a home.
Yes, but when we look at places like New York City, where not this past season, but the previous winter season, there was a tornado that hit in Brooklyn. Hurricane Sandy, decimated parts of Far Rockaway and Long Island and parts of Brooklyn.
The coastal areas, yes.
So is there now added concern, potential buyers, that they should consider, even in these regions, of having similar sort of coverage as one would do, for the South?
Well, I don't think the concern is should be at the level that we have done here.
Right, understandably.
But the concern should be there now, particularly as Lawrence has been pointing out, we're having this climate change, this global climate change thing happening. You know, so very soon you're going to see insurance companies targeting these areas with their policies.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to Caribbean Forum with me, Ron Bob Semple, here on the Uhura Radio Network. We're chatting with Valance Williams. He's the vice president of Aegis Capital Group out in New York City, and a real estate agent, Joe Thomas, who is also a qualified massage therapist. If you'd like to join us in discourse, you can give us a call at 1-800-420-5593. That's 1-800-420-5593.
Ron, I would just like to throw in a quick little segue. You will notice that the Dow Jones has just gotten back to almost slightly beyond where it was when the market crashed in 2008. I would suggest to your to the listeners to pull out their 401k and IRAs from back then and take a serious look at it and see how much they have regained. And if they haven't regained substantially, then you need to do some shifting around the things. You know,
when you say shifting around, explain, please.
Well, what you mean, you might be absolutely too conservative, because if the stock market has doubled, then it means that if you were in mutual funds that were equity oriented, then you should be back to where you were before this madness started. if you were in something, if you were in a money market, which was paying less than anything because everybody got scared, and you forgot to restructure your money or replace your money, then you are in the same position as you were back then. So it's we're looking at a global economy that is getting stronger. The U.S. economy is getting stronger. So perhaps it is time for you to take a look. Pull out your 401k, your IRA, take a look. People are living longer. You need more money and everything. So that would be my suggestion.
Very good advice. Joe, what else do you want to share with us with regard real estate and concerns that one may have?
I really want to encourage a lot of first-time buyers, people who have never bought a house before, to really look into it. There are a lot of good programs, as I said last week. Whether you have bad credit and you don't have enough money for a down payment, there are federal programs, there are local home buying programs. There are some areas right now that the government is trying to revitalize. So therefore, they're offering a whole lot of incentives for people to actually buy homes in those areas. You know, particularly down here where we've had, you know, almost half of some communities with foreclosed homes. So again, it is something to look into. If people need more information, they can call me directly. I can, you know, do some counseling with them. I can steer them in the right direction. There's no reason right now why anybody who wants to should not be able to buy a home. And this is not just in Florida. This is right through the country right now.
And Val, you wanted to say?
I guess I should add to that, since I made the 401k IRA suggestion, please do give me a call. I may have some ideas that you can strengthen your retirement portfolio. I mean, when I was in my 30s and 40s, I never really thought this hard about what retirement means. But now that I'm a bigger boy, not always the numbers, I realize the importance.
Thanks for the clarification.
Really putting things away. So when we at the end of the show, I would definitely give you a number.
Yes, we were chatting a couple of days ago, Valens, about a project that you... I think we touched on it rather briefly last month.
Recognizing, and this is in keeping with the whole climate change thing that is affecting the economic situation, there are certain things that you do. You have to get foreign direct investment. So Leopard Capital is a private equity firm. What a private equity firm is, they get monies from private investors and put together a fund. In the case of Haiti and countries like in the Caribbean, once they've got money from private investors, the international agencies like the IMF and the World Bank and the International Fund for Finance would throw in some monies to match, because they know that they're coming in to create jobs and stabilize economies, right? Mm-hmm. So it's very possible that I could be taking this company, Leopard Capital, to begin into Guyana first, and then Trinidad next, and then Suriname, then Jamaica. We plan to do CARICOM. So we're in the embryonic stages. They just contacted me about traveling next month. So we're working out some details before that is done. So I will definitely be speaking on that further.
Valens. You mentioned the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, a few moments ago. Has the IMF been a fair friend to the Caribbean?
No, certainly not. This is why you need private equity. Mm-hmm. Because private equity don't go in, they're going in to invest in businesses to make profits. The IMF, under the guise of helping your economy grow, come in with a lot of rules and regulations that really stunt the growth, but with the rules and regulations,
right,
makes it difficult for the economic activity to spread out into the full country.
But if I could interject, what my whole thing with the IMF is, I think it keeps a certain level of dependency.
That's right.
Yes. I totally agree with that.
Yes, well, gentlemen, as I wrap up, starting with you, Joe, just some parting words for our listeners, please.
If you don't want to vote right now, please take a good look at home ownership. It's a great way to invest. Also, you can use some of that for 401k and that other and all those other certificates that you have sitting in your drawer that you're not sure about, as Balas just said. Take it out, take a look at it, get proactive with your investment. Investigate, you know, call me. 813-778-2671.
Repeat it again.
813-778-2671.
Balance? As a parting word, diversification is the word. Like you said, you may have a 401k, take a look at it. If you don't have a home, buy a home. Outside of buying a home, we have to understand what diversification is. Look at where the world is going. The technologies are taking over. God forbid you're at home, Apple and Google, when they first were in their embryonic stages. Google is $700 a year. All of these things, I remember Apple at $15 when Steve Jobs came back. So you have to look at the trends, right? And just diversify your portfolio. We are here to help you, right? My name is Val Williams. My number is 212-806-6374, 212-806-6374. From here on in, American economy is on the rise. The global economy is coming back. Europe, which was falling apart the other day, is stabilizing. So there might be a period of prosperity that we're encountering. So be prepared. Line yourself up.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. Thank you very much. Mind your business with Val Williams and Joe Thomas.
Okay.
We'll chat with the historian and author AUC Quayana next.
You've been listening to Mind Your Business on Caribbean Forum with Ron Bob Semple.
You're listening to WhoRadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.
Caribbean Forum. I'm Ron Bob Semple with you. Well, he became one of Guyana's most popular and controversial political activists, making his entry into the field as a teenager at the village level. He's born in Lusignan. As an author, a few of his best-known works are Next Witness, Scars of Bondage, and Buxton in Print and Memory. Now, this description befits none other than my special guest this morning, Brother AUC Quayana. Brother AUC, good morning and welcome back to Caribbean Forum here on the Uhuru Radio Network.
Oh, thank you very much, Brother Ron, and listeners, much respect.
Now, first, much respect to you too, my brother. It's always a pleasure. First of all, Brother Yusi, thank you for joining us this early in the morning, as you now reside on the west coast of the United States, where it's just 7 a.m.
Yeah, that's it.
Well, one of your recent books is Walter Rodney, His Last Days and Campaigns. Please share with us, Brother Yusi, a couple of moments in the last days of this extraordinary brother who's that stands out in your mind, or that stood out in your mind.
Thank you for this opportunity. It's not a recent book, really. It was recently published. It was a book written in Guyana in the 80s, 81 and 84, and published internally, you know, without a publisher. And then I think it is 2 years ago that Robert Lalji, who once lived and worked in Guyana, he was a broadcaster and so on, ran into it and asked my permission to publish it. So he published it in Birmingham with a big launching in Birmingham, which is recorded on CDs. These CDs are on sale.
Okay.
The new publication is very interesting because it has writings by people other than myself, and I welcome that because it brings Walter Rodney into a wider audience, you know, and you get more people looking at his work. And that to me was very interesting. One of the person who wrote the introduction was the Guyanese and Caribbean historian, Dr. Clem Sicheran, and Robert Lalji himself, the publisher, did editorials throughout the book. And he chose the title and everything, Walter Rodney, His Last Days and Campaigns. So it's not a new book, but it's newly published, and it's going well. We had a launching in Toronto on the 28th of November, I think it was, at a place called the Different Booklist Bookstore. And the turnout was very good. Guys from all over the place came, and they were very anxious to get it.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
He had me in Toronto for 10 days.
Right.
I had three appearances, all of them very, very well attended, and people are very kind.
Yes. As I mentioned, if you can share with us, Brother Yusi, some of the last moments of Brother Walter Rodney's life that really stood out in your mind, that really made an impact on you.
The last moments were tragic moments, and
yes.
I was not really in his company, but the last days and years I can talk about.
Please do.
Because the closest we got was when he came back from abroad, from Tanzania really, to live in Guyana. And that took place in 1974, soon after the Working People's Alliance had been formed. His family came first, his wife, Dr. Pat Rodney, and then he came. And by the end of 74, he was already there. And before he came back, he was well acclaimed in the country. He was a hero before he came back, because, as you know, he was barred from teaching at the University of Guyana. He
right.
had been appointed there by the Appointments Board. I don't know how universities work. But the Appointments Board, which is the academic body, I think, responsible for selecting people, appointed him to head the history department. And then the council, the university council, which always has a lot of political elements on it with their own agendas, non-academic, they reversed the appointment and vetoed it, so to speak. So Askria, which was very active at the time, took it up. They went to all the opposition parties, trade unions, opposition parties and all the trade unions, which are not necessarily opposition trade unions, but we developed a broad attack on this refusal to have Walter Ronnie teach at the University of Diana. Now, those are his early days, and returning his last days were spent on the campaign for freedom in Diana, because there was none, you know, there was no freedom. The freedoms had been whittled away by this new paramountcy that had been announced in 1974 with the Declaration of Sophia. These are history things, historical things. I mentioned them with no venom or bitterness, but that is how the thing unfolded, and I'm trying to answer your question.
Yes.
Walter Rodney began by giving some historical talks began on the parade ground. And the first talk he gave at the parade ground was very interesting, because a few hundred people were there. And he gave an anecdote which became part of Clem C. Churan's essay in this book, Teaching Lions to Fight.
Mm.
Because Walter Ronnie spoke of an exhibition somewhere on the continent of Africa, attended by a lion. The lion looked around this exhibition gallery, and there was a lot of hunting of lions, you know, in the exhibition, paintings of people who distinguished themselves by trapping and hunting lions. And the lion looked and shook his head and said, if only lions could paint.
Wow.
So this is what Clem C. Churan took up, teaching lions to paint.
Is there one particular characteristic, Brother Yusi, that you saw in Walter Rodney that made you say, as Arsenio Hall used to say, this man is special?
Yes, there are many, many, many such qualities. One of them is, you know, the way he dealt with people.
Mm.
He came from a country, he came from a continent where one-party states were flourishing after independence. They thought that was the thing to unite these countries, you know, which had been divided and ruled for so many years by outside forces. These African leaders all said one-party states was the way to go, because then the have everybody and they reduce competition to a minimum, and he felt that was a way to maintain sovereignty. He came from that kind of atmosphere and had an entirely different kind of attitude. Although he worked in it and was a great supporter of the process in Tanzania, but he, you see, as I said before on your program, and I have to repeat myself, in the 1950s when we started this anti-colonial movement of modern times, led by Chet Jagan and later Forbes Burnham and Lachman Singh and people of that stamp, we put ourselves forward as the people's champions, you know?
Mm.
This was the mentality we had at that time. We were going to set the country free and, I guess, the people free and so on. Then Walter Rodney came in as a different kind of focus. For the first time, the focus was on empowerment of the people. Not the leaders freeing the people, but the people freeing themselves, which is the way people have become free throughout history.
That's correct.
Nobody ever freed anybody, you know.
You're so right.
Yes, because Walter Rodney said that they're going to emancipate you and put you anywhere they like.
Mm.
So nobody frees anybody. People free themselves, or they are not free. And that is what he taught and implanted in the Guyanese psyche.
Mm.
Especially during the time he was there, and for about a decade after that, that focus was very, very, very prominent. Self-emancipation is the only true emancipation. And in councils, the way decisions were taken, well, we have begun some of that in ASCLEA and other organizations of that type, especially after we got in touch with C.L.R. James and his book Facing Reality, which was written after the Soviet invasion of the Republic of Hungary. Many workers in Hungary had decided to put a stop to what was going on there and were reforming and building up committees and councils and so on to make themselves the center of things rather than some government. And the Soviet troops crossed the borders and put an end to that movement. C.L.R. James and a few other people wrote a book called Facing Reality, which was very popular in Ghana among us.
Yes.
After this. Now, speaking of this, reminds me that yesterday in Guyana they launched a book of mine, which was written in 1972. It was called The Bauxite Strike and the Old Politics. The Bauxite Strike and the Old Politics. This was the strike that took place at the time of nationalization, when the government wanted to do something with the RILA pension funds,
okay,
other than what the workers wanted. And the workers rose up as one and opposed that thing for days. Well, I was in touch with them. It was also an ASCLEA group at McKenzie, citing a lot of the anti-popular things. For example, a Canadian official of the company once went into the nurses' hostel at night looking for prey, you know. And the management didn't want to deal with it, and this ASCLEA compound at ASCLEA came out and made it an issue. And the workers were very, very, very self-reliant, and they began to organize and represent themselves because the union had gone over to the side of the government.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to...
This book is about those days.
I was just about to say, if you just joined us, you're listening to Caribbean Forum. I'm Ron Bob Semple with you here on the Uhuru Radio Network. My very special guest this morning is Brother Ayusi Kwayana, author of several books, including Walter Rodney, His Last Days and Campaigns. Brother Ayusi...
And Brother Ron...
Yes, my brother.
Tell your audience that your special guest is an old man of 87 years old, almost 88. And so when he begins to talk of one thing, it's not only yesterday, it's other things come up and they are relevant. Because of the erasure of memory that has taken place, you know, the non-education in the schools in this respect and in other respects as well, I try to insert them for a younger generation.
Yes, my brother, and we are very much appreciative of that. Even at 87, in my estimation, and I'm sure in the estimation of many, many others, you still as sharp as a tack.
Well, I'm not 87. If I survive in another couple of months...
Months, it will be 88, absolutely.
87 plus, that was last birthday.
Brother, you see...
Yes, Walter Rodney, I'm telling you, you know, his great achievement. There's a group of people trying to tell us the world Walter Rodney has no legacy.
Mm.
He left no legacy. I don't know who these people are, but they've now discovered this. Yet, that was the person who was in the forefront of the reorganization of political culture in Guyana, you know? And after the bloody 60s, when races were fighting one another, when I say races, I don't mean two races, because many people do not know that the United Force was also part of that.
That's right.
And had a very, very militant wing called GUYS. You know, they did everything that any other people did, but have somehow escaped this stamp of what the others had to bear. But, you know, he was a person who, at a public level, a number of us is now coming out, have been reorganizing before he returned, and when he came, he thought he would go to the Working People's Alliance.
Yes.
But it's his presence, his freshness, his vision that inspired masses of people throughout Guyana of all races. And he came out to discussions, he came out to public meetings, he came out to rallies, he came out to marches. And things began to change for the better. Well, I should say as we thought.
Yeah, you're right, absolutely.
Because no, there's nothing you can call better here. My wife jumped and she heard me say, I have never experienced such corruption in my entire life.
Wow.
Because she was in Guyana when we were fighting corruption within the PNC government.
Yes, yes.
But I tell you, these people are out of hand. They have a lot of more money to deal with, and they understand that they do.
A few moments. Yes.
I'm sorry, I'm interrupting you instead of you interrupting me.
No. You're about to expound, but what I was about to say, a few moments ago you mentioned self-emancipation, and your next book to be published is Post-Emancipation Village Movement on Guyana. Could you give us a sneak peek as to what to expect in this publication, Brother Yusi?
Yes. Well, thank you very much. In this publication, the Post-Emancipation Villages of Guyana, it is the title involves how the Africans in Guyana, after emancipation, the so-called emancipation, created history. And by history, I mean world history. Because they did something that we have not found repeated in the same way in any other place. They came out of centuries of enslavement, and the colonial government was blocking their efforts to become self-sufficient. They did that, but not as totally as they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
But because of the crisis in the international sugar market, caused by British legislation, they continued to buy sugar from that was grown by people who were enslaved and competed with the Caribbean sugar and so on. That story has been told over and over. Some plantations were going bankrupt. Some of them were also cotton plantations, and the U.S. was big in the cotton trade. So there were some plantations that were available for sale, and these Africans networked among themselves and would collect people from about four plantations or so and go and buy out an old plantation. But what is remarkable, most remarkable about this, and what comes out when I give full exposure in the book, is the rules made for government by these new villagers who began with Victoria.
Mm.
Now, none of this is original research on my part. It is, I suppose, original thinking, because this research has been done by Alan Young. There was first a foreigner, a man from the United Kingdom named Cruikshank. I think he was from there, who wrote some sketches of village life, and there were other people who were writing. There were governor's reports, writing pieces of it and sending to their home office. But Alan Young and Norman Eustace Cameron wrote Evolution of the Negro between 1927 and 1929 or something like that, and had it published at the Daily Argosy in two volumes, and he has a lot of the village story in there. But you know, these things have never seen the light of day in the institutions of learning in Guyana. I don't know why, but they have never been prescribed books. And Cameron is very readable. He goes all over the world, but he does deal a lot with Guyana. So Alan Young came and put this into very formal treaties called Approaches to Local Self-Government in Guyana, published in 1958. And that book really awoke me to the self-emancipation that had gone on in Guyana. I didn't count it that, but it was very clear to me that this is what was going on. I'm borrowing there a word that later on I learned from Walter Rodney, and he called it self-emancipation. And so this is what the book is about, and especially the way those people drafted rules to govern themselves.
Mm.
You know, we hear a lot in the so-called classical studies about the Greek city-states and all of that.
Right.
And I'm showing where these Victoria pioneers went beyond the Greek city-states in several respects. It's a big claim, but it's there.
And then, just FYI, you know, the Village of Victoria was published by former slaves in British Guyana some 172 years ago.
Yes.
Yeah. Let us go back, Brother Ayusi, to 1947. You became a member of a small group of politicians led by Dr. Chetty Jagan, who formed the People's Progressive Party, which is currently in power in Guyana under the leadership of Donald Ramatar. In 1953, the PPP won a landslide victory in the country's first elections. You, Brother Ayusi,
first election under adult suffrage.
That's correct.
And everybody could vote at the age of 21, yes.
Absolutely.
A lot had gone on before that of great significance.
Mm.
Which is all erased and brushed aside, you know?
Yes, yes.
1953, of course, is the beginning of the modern political era, which I honor greatly.
Right.
But, you know, when you study the political history and see what people were up against and how they coped with it before that and just after the Finnish movement, it's a very rich story. But they are not teaching it in the schools. I'm saying that over and over again.
And speaking of teaching in the schools, you at that time, Brother Ayusi, left your job as a school teacher to assume the position of Minister of Communications and Works. Right. Why did you feel that was necessary?
Oh, I felt it was necessary because it wasn't necessary for me to become a minister. In fact, I didn't even want to run for parliament. My interest was in organizing and carrying out political education throughout the coast or in the interior or wherever we could get. My interest was, so it's a good question. I did do that, but that was not what I got into the movement for. I saw this Indian gentleman back from the United States. He was educated, he was a dentist, and picked up some political resources. He came back with his wife and was very active. They were active with people in Georgetown. At the time, Mr. Burnham, I think, was a student in London. And I saw this man, when once out of Georgetown, he was alone with this new message of freedom and this message against the plantation, which was comprised in his book called, a little pamphlet called Bitter Sugar. And I said, no, it's not fair for a man of, you know, just a man of one race to be fighting. And that is how I came out. And I joined the PAC, the Political Affairs Committee, sometime after it was founded. It was founded in 1946. I was nowhere around. I didn't even know about it. But when Jagan came in 1947 on the East Coast and began to campaign, I picked up his message and I said, no, I have to throw in my lot, because I was very much in touch with people of my own age group and others along the East Coast, throughout the East Coast, young teachers, you know, pupil teachers at the time, young assistant teachers. And I said, no, this is imbalanced. I have to put myself into this. And I went in there for that purpose. In other words, I went in there so that Africans should be represented in this new wave of political ferment. You get it?
Yes.
That is why I went there. I was not thinking of being anything.
Okay.
And in fact, I mean, I've told this story before. Dr. Jagan and I were driving one day in his car. I think it was a Hillman Mix he used to drive. And he was talking something, and I said, "Wait, you know, I'm not going into Parliament." And he said, "What?" And he said, "If you are not going, I am not going."
Wow.
He was very disgusted with the way a lot of the elected representatives voted on issues. You follow?
Yes.
And people do not know the closeness with which he thought and worked with, along with people like Martin Carter, who was a public servant, and couldn't even think of standing on a public platform in those days. And there are many others. Ivan Edwards, you know. Mr. Burnham, after he returned, China Rand Singh and people like that, but Rory Vespers, after he returned from England. A lot of these people have been trained abroad. And then in the rural areas, I can call so many names. Rampersad Saw, Edmund Ford, who is still there, he's a little older than I. Rigby Dover, who's in Toronto, I met him and I visited there. An old schoolmate of mine, one of my real friends, you know.
Mm.
People think my friends are people whose names appear with me in the newspaper. They don't know stories, you know. Real friends are not my schoolmates. I mean, they are my friends too, but my students are among my best friends now.
Absolutely. On that note, Brother UC, let's take a short break so you can just get a breather. We're chatting with Brother UC Kriana, author and an activist extraordinaire who is, always has a wealth of information whenever he graces Caribbean Forum with his presence or wherever one may see him. We'll be right back with Brother UC Kriana. Are you tired of too many reruns on Uhuru Radio? Want more live shows and fresh music? We do too. And we need your help. Uhuru Radio is upgrading. To serve you better, we are getting new broadcast software and new equipment for new and better programming. We need to raise $1,000 this month to make that change. So go to the Uhuru Radio donate link now and contribute whatever you can. No donation is too large or too small. Uhuru Radio is your media. We need your support. Donate today.
This is Alan Bomar Jones. The Uhuru Radio Network gives a voice to the voiceless and stands for freedom for African people everywhere. Support it with your contribution today.
On Sundays from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, we'll bring you Golden Sunday Sounds with me, Ron Bob Semple. A relaxing 3 hours of music from around the world. Music is the food of love. So tune in every Sunday evening from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Golden Sunday Sounds.
Simple, the voice of reason.
Welcome back to Caribbean Forum. I'm Ron Bob Semple with you until 11 a.m. We've got another half an hour or so. And we're chatting with Brother UC Kriana, author, political activist who is on the verge of celebrating his 88th birthday, and we are grateful that he can spend this time with us here on Caribbean Forum. Just before the break, Brother Yusi, we were talking about your having joined the government as a minister, the Minister of Communication and Works, and unfortunately back then the British government had suspended the constitution and threw the PPP out of office after some 133 days. You were a political detainee. You held vigil outside the governor's office. You held executive membership of both major political parties, the PPP and the People's National Congress. You're a composer of the anthems of both parties. In spite of all that, Brother AUC, how were you able to find time to provide lessons for hundreds of students, most of whom were indigent?
After the suspension of the constitution, you know, people, I had become a minister overnight, and I was determined not to go to the government to ask for work, whatever government it was. So I first began to work as a carpenter in the village. I worked with Scotty Jarvis.
And that's the village of Buxton.
Village of Buxton, yes. Mm. Scotty Jarvis was a well-known contractor. They called him Akuram. I worked with him for about 2 years, along with Cordy and Patrick Rowland and some other brothers. And then I decided to start a school. And I called that school County High School. It's the only thing I started on my own. They always say I'm founder of this and founder of that. I have been a co-founder of things, but the only thing I founded on my own was that school. And that was in 1956. And it began with one student. It began with one single student above a store in a place they called Ebony Club on along Buxton Middle Walk.
Would you happen to remember the name of that student?
Yes.
And his or her name is?
One second. Her name is... the only time I'm not remembering that name.
It's quite all right. I'm sure he'll come back.
Her mother was a Primo. I'm seeing her now.
Yes, I'm sure it'll come back.
I always remember her name.
Yes. You can continue, Brother, you see.
Yeah, and it grew, you know, it grew just like that by word of mouth, so to speak. I put out a handbill, and it grew. And it came to about something like 250 students eventually. And then there were lectures in the afternoon for people who were taking examinations, you know, there were adult classes as well. People paid fees, but the fees were very reasonable. And we had one principle that I didn't want to know who paid fees or who didn't pay fees. Mm. I had to collect fees after the school grew. The deputy principal collected the fees. And we never read out the names of people who did not pay fees and told them to go home and that kind of thing, you know. And people are telling me that now, but I never knew or wanted to know. Because I'm teaching, you see.
That's where your focus was.
Yeah.
You mentioned that that's a school that you...
We got a proposal. We had about 20 students, one student to every 20 students, one teacher to every student, to every 20 students eventually. And the deputy principal, came to a point where the deputy principal was a former student and had become a UG graduate. Today he's a PhD. And my wife taught in that school too after we married and so on. So we kept a good staff, a very conscious staff. And we had a ratio of about 1 to 20 students.
Was it challenging for you?
It was, you know, it looked challenging to other people. It's a challenge to other people. Then you, when you're doing something you want to do, it's not challenging.
I know what you mean.
Challenge you. I'm sure what you're doing there is something I can't do.
Don't be so sure, my brother Yusi. You mentioned that that's the only thing that you quote-unquote founded, and you co-founded a lot. And you co-founded the African Society for Racial Equality, and later the African Society for Cultural Relations with Independent Africa. These groups became part of the Working People's Alliance, the WPA, of which Walter Rodney was a member.
Yeah.
How pivotal a role did you play in the struggle for democratic restoration in Guyana?
Well, that's putting me on the spot. You want me to say I played a critical role in this struggle? I don't do that. I never do that. No, you're putting me on the spot. Yeah.
But how?
I was active. You know, I did what I could do.
Right. Right.
What was available to me, I tried to do. And right now, I'm very concerned with the balance of political forces in Guyana. I think I mentioned to you that I wanted to talk about that.
Yes, and please, please, I've opened the door for you.
I did what I could. In fact, I joined this. We went and saw Dr. Jaban and he heard the 1973 election by State Home. I listened to that thing all day and I was sure that it had been doctored, you know. And so a number of us started to, we included them in this campaign, this Rodney campaign, Employ Rodney campaign in 1974. I was the person who called the 1973 elections selections, you know. That didn't come from the PPP. The press came to interview me about it. I said, well, you need a selection. And it stuck, so everybody picked it up. Now, I paid a lot of attention to constitutional movements and what was going right and what was going wrong, to corruption and that kind of thing. And we, as Astria in those days, we took action in the available channels. Now, that is not me. That's a body of persons all this time. But since November 28, 2011, things are very distorted in Guyana, you know. Things are very, very distorted. I don't think there was any rigging of that election. I happen to be in Guyana early December from about the 6th because my brother passed away in Buxton, and my wife and I and a son of ours, we got some people helped us with frequent flyer miles and money, and we went home to the funeral. And while there, I stayed in Buxton all the time. Buxton, which had been a hot spot which I could not return to.
Yes.
Because of what was happening in 2002 with the arms and all that madness.
Yes.
And the atmosphere there was very, very welcome after the election. I was not there during the campaign. And as the results came out to me, you know, I sat with a lot of young people in the night spot. I was going for a walk and they said, you must drop in. Of course, I arrived in the airport in a wheelchair and people probably thought this chap can't walk, but that's how I travel these days.
Okay.
I do manage to, as Prophet Wills would say, perambulate.
Yes, right, absolutely. That's right, Prophet Wills. Out of Buxton too.
I'm lucky to be able to walk daily and that kind of thing. And I met these young people and we talked for over an hour. I found no bitterness whatever. And to me, that is an indication. So what happened in November 28, 2011, is that these groups reorganized. They went in various groupings. WPA joined in a grouping with the PNC, which was something impossible. In 2006, when this idea came up, and I was over here, and they sent me an email asking what I thought, to go to some meeting in New York, I didn't even go. Because I asked them, what are you going to say on the platform with the PNC? You follow?
Yes.
That was my attitude in 2006. I was not at all interested in what went on. It didn't come off. They fought separately and were defeated separately. But this time when they said they were forming a campaign for national unity, I said, no, well, this is a resumption of an old struggle. Because unless that country looks in that direction, it's going to be fissured eternally. And you know what is going on there with women being raped and assaulted and disrespected, and children, and every blessed day there is somebody shot somewhere. You know? That country has never, under any of the rulers, clamped down on illegal arms. Guns in Guyana seem to be as popular as bread.
Yes.
So, you know, that kind of thing. And it hit me that this is the way to go. This country has to heal itself. Those tensions have to be exploded and resolved so that people can go about a normal life. And this question of victory and who's on top, and these old-fashioned slogans and objectives, are totally irrelevant. When you find yourself in a country that is multi-ethnic, unless you can make something of it, all the ethnics will suffer, all, without exception. Some will suffer in one way, some will suffer in another way. And I don't want to go into that. But this is the pattern universally.
Yes.
So I felt this is what happened in that election. The PPP's candidate, Mr. Ramatar, won something like 48.something% of the vote, and according to the constitution he was entitled to be president.
Yes.
I see they're calling it 49-point-something now, but I don't know the figures. Anyway, everybody accepts that he came first, and he, under the Burnham Constitution, he became president. Mr. Granger was the president for candidate for APNU. He did not win the presidency. But I think the parties did creditably. The AFC, the Association for Change,
Alliance for Change.
The Alliance for Change, they did very well. And so the scores were APNU 32, Alliance for Change 7, and the PPP 32. APNU 26, the Alliance for Change 7, PPP 32.
You're referring to the seats?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I beg your pardon?
You're referring to the seats?
The seats?
Yes.
The Parliament.
Uh-huh.
No, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights says, the will of the people shall be the basis of the authority of government, Article 21. The will of the people shall be the basis of the authority of government, and it shall be expressed in periodic elections. What's the will of the people? It's an election. The will of the people did not give the PPP a majority. The president has the right to appoint ministers and choose a cabinet. Under Article 103 of the Constitution, the President may appoint ministers from among people who are elected members of the National Assembly.
Mm-hmm.
The Constitution does not say he must appoint all of them from his party list. So I say it is an affront to democracy for a party to fail to win the majority and to grab all the cabinet posts. And that is what has happened there. And they are conceding the fact that he had the option. He's not compelled to. But I felt that if this gentleman was really interested in healing that country, all he had to do was to open negotiations with the opposition parties. And I can't tell, I won't I won't even suggest to them what they should do. But his duty as president and the one with the power to appoint the government is really the cabinet. With the power in his hands under the Constitution to appoint from among all the members of parliament, apart from the four technocrats who will come in from outside. There is no evidence that he opened any such negotiations to ask whether you all will consider a national government, whether they want to call it unity or what. But I think the people were in a mood to unite. Now, breaking down racially, a number of Indian Guyanese supported the AFC and other people as well, but the bulk of support came from Indians, it is everybody is saying. And because of Moses Nagamatu and the same Mr. Kemraj was the leader, and then there was Mr. Raphael Trotman and Mr. Hughes on the other side, they attracted support. You can't be counting heads. This is a national consensus I'm talking about. The man named Dr. Ram Charan, Bertrand Ram Charan, I saw him when I went to Toronto. He came to a meeting I was at and gave me a book he had written talking about the national consensus. Because people who understand the structure of the world are aware of this. You don't go in a small country with many races and look for trouble, look for fissures and conflict, you know. You have as much consensus as possible because there are resources to be distributed, and that's the bottom line in all countries. Now, so, and then on the other hand now, you find Atmul that fought on the base. Has not defined the new political situation. I'm saying the new political situation in Guyana does not permit a one-party government by any stretch of the imagination. The Guyana Constitution says sovereignty belongs to the people,
yes,
and they express it through elections. The International Declaration of Human Rights laid that foundation after the Second World War. So where are we going? Where do you look for the authority of government? Where do you look for an expression of the will of the people if you are having elections? You see, even in Victoria they knew that. They had annual elections in Victoria in 1840.
We just have about 8 or so minutes left, Brother Yussi.
Yes.
What is lacking, just listening to you, what is lacking in Guyana that would create cohesion among its people?
What is lacking is a recognition that the country belongs to everybody, that it does not belong to some clique, you know? And this applies to the two major parties. Each of them wants to win and dominate. And that's the only reason. Well, in this case, you know, I have faulted the PNC without limit. And a lot of PNC people will not like what I'm saying. I understand them. I was in the PNC at one stage.
Absolutely.
You know, I wrote the song.
That's right.
And as you kindly reminded us. And I wrote the Working People's Alliance song as well, and the PPP song as well.
Yes, you did.
And now, I'm writing these songs because this is a movement I feel is a good movement. And it needs, you know, that kind of poetic encouragement and motivation. I'm not writing it to get a post or anything like that. So there are these people now on both sides of the divide. The winner, the so-called the president, well, there are no winners and losers because the PPP won the presidency, the opposition won the parliament.
Yes.
And the fault has to go to the executive. Failure to put out an initiative to gather the national forces. You're talking a lot about the nation. What nation? You don't have a nation if you can't go to your fellow country people and say, did you consider a national government on the basis of the election which the opposition, so-called opposition forces won? And I think this is not being put to the international community. The PPP has ordered its own message to the international community saying that the opposition is trying to make the country ungovernable. Now, they're not going to tell me that. I was in town. I was there.
Mm.
since 1947. And I would not allow Mr. Ramotar and his friends to put that message out to the international community. Take Linden. My book shows that in 1970, the people of Wisma and Mackenzie, led by the workers, rose up against attempts of a government that they supported to interfere with their economic gains. I have not taken a position on the electricity charges. This time, because those people are excluded from the cabinet through their representatives, they are agitating on economic grounds. And the government is saying that this is a racially motivated thing against an Indian government. That is nonsense. If it is so, then how is it that they conducted this agitation in the 1970s, which forced me to write this book, The Bauxite Strike and the Old Politics in 1972. I'm not writing it now to make an excuse and to argue with Mr. Ramotar. Mm-hmm. It was there. It is part of our history. Unfortunately, I wrote the experience down. So here were Africans fighting an African government. Here it happens to be an Indian government, but they are fighting a government which is Indian. It is not because it is Indian. And that's the message he is trying to put out to save the bankruptcy of the political culture here now. That is my beef. I don't eat beef, but that is my beef.
Just this past week, Brother Yusi, the Speaker of the National Assembly, Raphael Trautman, to whom you alluded a few moments ago, he allowed Home Affairs Minister Clement Rohi to speak in the House after a motion was passed to the contrary. After this spat of violence in Linden and Agricola and other parts of the country, what is your reaction to the opposition walking out when Mr. Rohi took the podium?
People have a right to walk out if they want to walk out and they don't want to hear a speaker. I don't want to get into that ruling and that conflict over the speaker and the speaker and the ruling, because I am trying to work it out myself.
You see,
the Constitution, I haven't yet seen the form of the motion of no confidence, but I say this, that in any decent country with decent ministers, if that thing took place under a certain minister, a decent-minded democratic minister would resign immediately. That has not happened in Guyana. Nobody has asked him to resign. So I am not getting into the arguments. They're too far away to get into such arguments and standing orders and all of that, you know?
Right, right.
But I know that when a minister fails, that is a failure of management of the Ministry of Home Affairs. And I have a lot to say, which I can't go on at this time of this interview.
We'll have to continue that, I'm sure.
That whole Linden thing was totally uncalled for.
Absolutely.
As a high police officer said, the shooting was unnecessary. The Constitution guarantees freedom of assembly.
Yes.
And any modifications of that have to be in the Constitution.
Well, as usual, Brother Yusi, there is never enough time when you join me on my broadcast. We oftentimes do run out of time, but I certainly will have you back on the broadcast. And just very quickly, before I let you go, what's next for One AU Sequoyana?
Oh, well, I am at a stage now when we are looking, people of my age ought to be looking, you know, elsewhere. This is not the only world, as they say. by any computation, by any medical or mathematical or statistical analysis, you know.
Well, Brother Yusi, thank you very much for joining me once more here on Caribbean Forum. All the best to you and
thank
your
you
endeavors.
Listen,
yes.
I want to know where you're located.
Yeah, I'm broadcasting out of Tampa, Florida.
Tampa, Florida?
That's correct.
Tampa, Florida. Thank you very much.
Yes.
You thought this was Florida. Okay, then.
Okay, my brother.
Thank you. Can you send us a link?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Yes, brother. Yes, it's brother Yussi Kayana, the author and the political activist, joining us here on Caribbean Forum. Well, February is African History Month, and it's being celebrated in Florida here. And I have the honor of presenting my one man, Looking Back, Moving Forward, The Spirit of Marcus Garvey. It will be on Tuesday and Wednesday, February 12th and 13th, at the studio at 620. The studio at 620 is located at 620 First Avenue South in St. Petersburg, Florida. That's February 12th and 13th at 7:30 p.m. And for reservations, one can call 727-895-6620. That's 727-895-6620. Looking Back, Moving Forward, The Spirit of Marcus Garvey, my one-man cultural and educational presentation on the ideologies and philosophies of the father of black nationalism. And just before we go, on Sunday, well, tomorrow the 10th, the 28th year, a Grammy Award for Reggae will be handed out to a lucky singer of this genre. This year's nominees are Jimmy Cliff for Rebirth, The Original Wailers for Miracle, Sean Paul for Tomahawk, Technique, Sly and Robbie and Jam Masters for New Legend, Jamaica 50th Edition, and Toots and the Maytals for Reggae Got Soul. And meanwhile, American Idol judge and Trinidadian rapper Nicki Minaj will be missing in action from the awards. She has not received a single nomination for this year's Grammy, even though she had one of the 2012 biggest hits with her Red One produced multi-platinum dance pop single. Well, thank you for listening to us this morning. Watch your thoughts, they become words. Watch your words, they become actions. Watch your actions, they become habits. Watch your habits, they become character. Watch your character, for it becomes your destiny. If it is to be, it is up to me. Stay strong and be aware. I'm Ron Bob Semple. Have yourself an enjoyable weekend. Happy birthday to Robert Nesta Marley.